From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Biotech companies launch a 50 million PR campaign trying to change the term genetically engineered food to simply say biotechnology. Anti-globalization activists fight back. Today we'll hear from Jeremy Rifkin and Vandana Shiva. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A coalition of biotech companies is spending $50 million this year on a marketing campaign to keep fears over genetically altered foods from spreading from Europe to the United States. Bankrolling the huge marketing campaign, which includes $32 million in TV and print advertising, are Monsanto, Dow Chemical, DuPont, Swiss-based Novartis, the British Zeneca, and Aventis of France. At the forefront of this corporate coalition is NatureMark, Monsanto's effort to genetically engineer a potato that doesn't bruise or soak up as much oil when fried. Among the new campaign's first goals is to get Americans to refer to the industry as Americans to refer to the industry as biotechnology rather than using the label genetically modified organism or GMOs. Many analysts say this new advertising blitz is a result of increased public protest of genetically modified foods and the so-called biotech industry as a whole. Today, we're going to hear from two leaders of the movement that deals with biotechnology, Vandana Shiva of India and Jeremy Rifkin, prominent in the movement that examines the moral and scientific implications of genetic engineering and president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. He's author of both Beyond Beef and the book The Biotech Century. We turn now to Jeremy Rifkin.
Let me begin by registering a complaint. You know, for the last 30 years, our futurists, our forecasters, have been forecasting the information age. So we've had a robust discussion about the information revolution all over the world. Let me respectfully disagree with Alvin Toffler, my old friend John Nesbitt, George Gilder, all the forecasters. I think calling the 21st century the information age is a little like calling the industrial age the print press age. What I mean by this is we've misunderstood the role of the information science revolution. The computer is not a raw resource upon which new economies are built, but it is a communication tool upon which new eras are founded. And it bears an analogy with the print press. You recall when Gutenberg reinvented the print press in 1450, the Chinese had it already. At first, it didn't have much of an economic mission. It played its first powerful role in the Protestant Reformation. The ability to mass produce those books allowed each believer to bear witness and not have the priesthood or the Vatican as their intermediary to God. It was a revolution. But the economic impact of the print press didn't become clear until the 1600s, actually early 1700s, when it was harnessed together with steam power and coal. It became the language to organize the Industrial Revolution. You needed a communication tool that was agile, quick, flexible, to be able to deal with a fast-paced, high-energy, fossil-fuel culture, the print press. You could not have organized the Industrial Revolution with oral and script culture. Similarly, for the last 30 years, we've been tracking two emerging technologies, one a form of communication, the other a resource base. Computers, genes. The information sciences, the life sciences, software and wetware. In the last several years, these emerging technologies of the 21st century have begun to fuse together to create a powerful union, a paradigm for a whole new era in history. The computer is going to play many roles in the 21st century. We're using it for personal information, we're using it for entertainment, The economy, the capitalist economy, is using it to shift from markets to networks, from geography to cyberspace, from ownership to access relations, a great change in the way we do business. But from an anthropological perspective, if you step back for a moment, the primary mission of the computer, it's the language to organize genes, to download them, to decipher them, to manage them, to exploit them. Genes for food, pharmaceuticals, medicine, food, fiber, energy, construction, building materials. The new field is called bioinformatics. It's the bridge between the information and life sciences, and you may want to know that Bill Gates and Microsoft and IBM are now creating strategic alliances with the big life science companies. To understand the enormity of this, and when I mean enormity, we're shifting our resource base from fossil fuels, metals, and minerals, the raw resource of the industrial age, to genes, the raw resource for the biotech century. Take a look at four companies, Monsanto and DuPont in the United States, Novartis, Aventa in Europe. These were chemical giants of the 20th century. They brought us the Industrial Revolution. In the last 4 years, every one of these chemical companies made the decision to sell and shed their entire chemical divisions, to be exclusively in the life sciences, to be in biotech. So this is one of the great changes in history. You know, up to now, the debate has been a debate that has been set by the industry. We can congratulate ourselves here today, but we've been placed in the negative. And the debate's been set by industry. They say either you're for the future or you're against progress. You're for science or you're a Luddite. Am I correct? Putting us in the uncomfortable position of being a wrench in the framework, but without our own story. The issue here is not the science. How many of you studied genes in school? Did you walk out of class when they taught you about the genes? No. Would you tell your children you shouldn't learn about genes? Of course not. We need to understand there's a difference between the science and the applied science. There is a hard path and a soft pathway to approach the age of biology, because here's where the done deal is. We're moving from the age of chemistry and physics to the age of biology. That is a fait accompli. What we haven't decided yet, how do we want to organize this period of history? Right now, we have the Monsanto agenda. It's hard path. I'm going to suggest there is a soft path based on a totally different worldview, completely different approach to science and technology, and an approach that requires absolutely no gene splicing, no recombinant DNA technology. A path that in the long run will more benefit future generations, keep our options open, pay proper respect to our responsibility to our fellow creatures, and be in line with the values of the young people in this room. Let me start with a hard path. For some 25, that's more than that, years now, when we've discussed this issue, the scientists have said, Mr. Rifkin, what is the problem here? Why do you have a problem with our approach to using this technology? We've been breeding nature and domesticating nature for 10,000 years since the dawn of the Neolithic Revolution. Isn't gene technology just a more sophisticated way to get the job done? Let me disagree. I'm going to give you a set of four experiments that could not have been done by any classical breeder in history. Four experiments that we've never seen conducted in evolutionary terms. Experiment one, University of Pennsylvania. Scientists took a human growth hormone gene, a human gene, micro-injected it into a mouse embryo. The mouse was born with a human gene functioning in every cell of its body. These mice grew twice as big and twice as fast as any mice in history, and they passed that human gene to every generation of their offspring. You can't do that in classical breeding. In classical breeding, we can cross some biological boundaries because taxonomy is an anthropocentric invention of human beings. So we say that's a donkey, that's a horse, but they're close enough relatives, we can cross them and have a mule. But in classical breeding, we cannot cross a horse in an apple tree. Here we can, and that's the point of this whole experiment. We now are no longer constrained by the biological boundaries, the teleology of a species. We can eliminate that organism level, move right to the information encoded within it, and begin to strip genes out and recombine them. Let me drop back a minute with an analogy. For thousands of years, we've been using fire technologies. We're a very Promethean creature up until the turn of this century. We've been burning, we've been soldering, we've been melting, we've been heating all the inner crust of this earth, and we've created a second genesis. Steel, glass, cement, cinnabar, plastics. The apotheosis of the fire revolution, we split the atom in the 1940s. In the early 1970s, two biologists, Boyer and Cohn, University of California and Stanford, did something in biology that some believe is comparable to fire technology. They took slices of genetic material from unrelated species and stitched them together, recombined them, creating a new form of life that had never existed before, the process you all know now, these 25 years later, recombinant, recombined DNA. But instead of burning, soldering, forging, melting, and heating inert materials, we now talk about stitching, editing, sequencing, and recombining living information across biological boundaries to create new efficient utilities. But here's the difference. This is life. This is life. And it raises a whole different set of questions for your generation and your children in the 21st century. Experiment two. Scientists took a gene that emits light in a firefly. They stripped it out and put it in a mouse embryo. The mouse was born and it lights up 24 hours a day. Can't do that in classical breeding. Luther Burbank could not have conceived of that experiment. Goats and sheep, if you're from farms, you know these are unrelated species. They, no matter how lonely they may be in the barnyard, nothing's going to happen here. Scientists at Edinburgh, for some reason, Edinburgh's where they like to do these bizarre experiments. I don't know if it's the weather, the long winters. I've been to Edinburgh. It seems like it's a normal place. They took a sheep embryo and a goat embryo, fused them together, gave birth to a geep. This is a new species. It never existed before. It has the head of a goat, the body of a sheep. It's a chimera, right out of ancient Greek mythology. Can't do that in classical breeding. And finally, cloning. We all miss the story. In our narcissism, especially the media, we're so consumed, will we do it to ourselves? And of course, if we haven't, let me just say, it's only a matter of when the fertility clinic, the first one, wants to take the move. But the real story was not Dolly. Do you know what the second sheep's name was? That's the big sheep in the industry, Polly. And you didn't hear anything about Polly. Polly, what they did is they took an adult cell from the sheep. Then they customized a human gene into the genetic code, then they cloned the cell into a sheep. And what they demonstrated to the investment community is it's now possible to both customize and mass produce identical copies of a living original with the same quality controls and design standards and engineering principles we applied on the assembly line in the first stages of the second industrial revolution. So that we can begin to use these procedures to create factory animals that produce pharmaceuticals and xenotransplants and research models. There's a reason we call this genetic engineering. It's not therapy. It's engineering. And what are engineering skills? Do we have any engineers here? See if I'm correct. Engineering assumptions, quality control, quantifiable standards of measurement, predictable outcomes, low ratios of thermodynamic efficiency, don't want a big entropy bill, and utility. Now we're talking about applying those standards directly into the blueprints of millions of years of evolution. That's what this game's all about. That's the hard path. We're told about all the great benefits. We'll cure diseases, we'll feed the world, we'll have new sources of energy when the oil spigot runs dry. On the other hand, this is the most radical experiment ever conceived at the hands of human beings. Do we create a second genesis in the lifetime of the young people and your children in this room in the 21st century? Do we substitute the natural world with cloned, chimeric, and transgenic animals and create a laboratory-conceived second genesis? What are the implications in releasing thousands of genetically modified organisms in relation to spreading genetic pollution and irreversible damage to this thin biosphere we live in? What are the consequences in designing our babies at conception and growing up in a world where we're genetically profiled and rights and discrimination are based on our genotypes? This is a heady venture. I want to spend some minutes with you on the hard path. Then I want to talk about the soft path, the better story. The name of the game is genes. Whoever controls the genes controls the 21st century. It's as simple and profound as that. And that's why intellectual property is critical to this process. It is impossible at this stage to create a gene de novo in the laboratory, a useful gene. You have to go out and find it in nature. It's an extractive industry, just like oil. So as you know, the life science companies, the genomic companies, are setting up bioprospecting all over the world. It turns out that all the resources worth exploiting happen to be in the equatorial belt and in the southern hemisphere, because that's where our biodiversity still remains. So they're looking for microbes and plants and animals and indigenous human populations that may have valuable genes that can be commercially exploited. And as soon as they seize the gene, they claim it as an invention. This is the biggest power grab in history. Now, you all know that the Human Genome Project right now in Canada and the US and around the world is unlocking the secrets of life. It's exciting. I favor it, actually. We're learning about the genetic code of life. And I should say, as long as we understand the gene is not all powerful, we're getting this message from industry, the gene is everything. Well, as one of my friends in the scientific community said, the gene is not the recipe, it's simply ingredients. There is a choreography between genotype and phenotype, genetic expression, environmental triggers, nature and nurture. But if we understand that the gene is an interesting part of the puzzle of life, this is exciting. What we're not told is every time a gene is isolated, cystic fibrosis, Huntington chorea, sickle cell anemia, the breast cancer gene, it's claimed as an invention. Within the next 10 years, all 140,000 genes that make up the blueprint for human evolution will be mapped, and every single one of them will be the intellectual property in the form of an invention by a life science company. Now, I have no problem with commerce. I work with business leaders and CEOs all over the world on various economic issues. The market has a function, as long as we understand that it's essential to our life, but not sufficient to define and be the ultimate arbiter of our life, correct? When a handful of companies can own the genetic blueprints of human evolution, we have to pause, take a deep breath, and reflect, giving them the power not over our daily lives, but the future evolution of our children's generation and our legacy. Well, all the rare genes are in the South. They're bioprospecting, and now our friends in the southern countries are saying biopiracy, correct? These are our genes. Now, early on, many of the countries, and some still do, say we want to be compensated. It took maybe 8 or 9 years for some of the civil society organizations in this room, some of the leaders, to hammer away and say, look, while it may make sense at first you want to be compensated, but wait a minute, who do these genes really belong to? Brazil is a political construct that's been here for less than 100 years and probably won't be here in 300 years from now. Evolution's been here from the dawn of our history. So genes should not belong to countries, and genes should not belong to companies. It's the legacy that all of us need to steward as a trust. Because if we allow the gene pool to be the political property of governments, even in the developing countries, or the intellectual property of global corporations, I guarantee you, young people, that your children will have gene wars in the 21st century.
Jeremy Rifkin, prominent in the movement examining the moral and scientific implications of genetic engineering, president of the Foundation on Economic Trends and author of Beyond Beef and his latest book, The Biotech Century. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, Vandana Shiva, author of Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As biotech companies launch their $50 million blitz, that's right, $50 million that Novartis and Monsanto and Dow and the British-based Zeneca company, the German-based BASF company and others put $50 million into public relations, $32 million of it going into radio and TV advertising to defeat the anti-biotechnology movement that has raged in Europe that they want to prevent from raging here. We bring you two leaders of the movement dealing with biotechnology. You just heard Jeremy Rifkin. Now we turn to Vandana Shiva. She's author of Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply. She was given the Right Livelihood Award, an alternative Nobel Peace Prize in 1993, and is director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in India. Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking recently at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
There is no room for making money out of water, making money out of seeds, making money out of childbirth, making money out of everything that happens on its own terms with nature and small producers, creating and producing freely. And the place where much of this change is happening in terms of declaring the self-regeneration of life as theft. The sunshine is supposed to nourish all biodiversity, you suddenly declare. The plants that are not your patented seeds are all thieves. In 1989, Carla Hills, do any of you remember Carla Hills? She used to be your trade secretary, who's a pest around the world. And, you know, Carla Hills came to India and basically had a press conference and said, with a crowbar, we are going to open up India's markets for U.S. business. You know, she came and then Ron James came and now President Clinton is going for the same job, being errand boys and girls for American business. But when she talked about, you know, opening up Indian markets with a crowbar, I send the clipping from Delhi to farmers' organizations that I work with. And that particular year, Cargill had entered for the first year for seed sales. As a result of World Bank conditionalities, which had forced India to open up the seed markets to the entry of multinationals. And Cargill sold, the first year it sold sunflower. It said it would their sunflower would produce 8 tons, 12 tons an acre, and it produced 2 tons an acre. Farmers were mad. So there were protests, and these farmers had just read this press clipping, so they literally, they physically took crowbars to this factory and tore down, stone by stone, the entire factory. And then Cargill held a press conference saying, these Indian farmers are so stupid, they don't realize they're missing out on these smart, intelligent technologies that help us prevent the bees from usurping the pollen. Now, can you imagine the world? You know, it has biodiversity that steals sunshine, bees that steal pollen, and then farmers who save seed. You have to save seed if you're a farmer, are now suddenly thieves who are stealing intellectual property. The laws have been put into the World Trade Organization, but they're already being implemented here because whatever was put into the WTO was basically exercised in the US for a decade before that. More than 1,500 US farmers have been sued by Monsanto for doing what farmers should do, which is save seed. There's a very dramatic case of a Canadian farmer who was sued by Monsanto for being a thief. And he said, but I never planted your rapeseed. I never bought rapeseed from you. I never planted it from you. He said, you didn't buy it from us, but you stole it and planted it. Because they, you know, they go around spying and having detectives. They literally hire detective agencies to check if farmers have saved seed or if farmers have their genetically engineered crops. Now, Percy Schmeisser, this Canadian farmer, had never, ever planted genetically engineered seed, but his rapeseed had been contaminated by pollen from other people's genetically engineered rape. And Monsanto, with its typical style, had collected these rape samples and, you know, done the DNA test and found that there is I think this was Roundup-resistant canola, and it had the Roundup-resistant traits in it. So Percy Schmeisser was clever. He just countersued for pollution. He said, "You have polluted my field." Now, that case hasn't yet been heard, but he came to meet me just before Seattle. And he said they terrorize him every day when he goes to his farm. They have cars going round. They have people with guns. He's an old man of about 70. And he says if there was anyone with a little less grit to fight back, they'd have been destroyed by now. The intellectual property rights, as they have been enlarged and defined in the World Trade Organization, have a very interesting history. Intellectual property rights and agriculture never belonged to trade issues. And you might recall that the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs was born a little north of here in Bretton Woods, along with the World Bank and IMF. And the GATT was supposed to have led to an institution like the World Bank and IMF, except that the institution was finalized through a meeting in Havana on the basis of a Havana Charter, and we were supposed to have an international trade organization. At that point, the third world countries had just become independent. They wanted an equitable trading system. They had equity in trading. The US couldn't tolerate it. So they killed ITO. And the GATT continued as an arrangement of agreement between nations on goods beyond your borders. All it could regulate was the trade in goods beyond national borders. But by the mid-80s, national markets in the north were saturated, corporations were looking for markets overseas, and trying to create new markets of the things that hadn't been markets. Life, biodiversity, one of them. Food, never been a globally tradable commodity, governed by free trade rules. So the four new areas that were brought into the WTO, into the GATT at that time, were agriculture, intellectual property rights, services, and investment. Now, when they brought in intellectual property rights, our Indian negotiator said, "No way, this doesn't belong to international law, and it doesn't belong to international trade. This is about national sovereign law, and it belongs to the domain of recognizing and rewarding innovation, ensuring people's basic needs are met." The American negotiators went back to Washington, and you know Washington's run by lawyers who can create any term out of anything and get it into any document. So they went back and said, "Okay," they said, "it's not trade-related. We'll make it trade-related by calling it trade-related intellectual property rights." And he said, "Now it's trade-related by definition." And in 1993, when the Uruguay Round was completed, well, not completed, Dunkel, poor man Dunkel, submitted a text. And then the US and Europe continued to fight over agriculture. It's only in 95 it got completed. But in 93, when the negotiations were over, at a meeting in Washington, the Monsanto representative stated that what we achieved in the intellectual property rights agreement is unprecedented in history. We defined a problem and we offered its solution. We went to our government, convinced it. Then we took this law to the GATT Secretariat, convinced them. And then we went to other important trading partners, convinced them. And in the drafting of trade-related intellectual property rights, we were the patient, the physician, and the diagnostician all in one. That's how today we have an international law that forces countries to have patents on life, patents for seeds, or seed monopolies. Now, when this started to happen already in 87, 89, we started to question it. We started to question it for the same reason I would question Coca-Cola owning a village commons in the form of a tank or water body that will generations of village communities create, maintain, and sustain. Because life forms are not an invention. And to claim a patent means to claim an invention. All that genetic engineering corporations do is basically shuffle genes, and they have to admit that's about all they can really manage. It's like taking chairs from this building into a building somewhere else in Cambridge, into Harvard University. And with that chair in a Harvard building, saying, not only did we move the chair, but we made the building, and therefore we are owners of it. You don't go around doing that with real estate, but you can do it with something far more important, which is life itself. The gene shufflers were redefined as life creators. And that is the basis of how patents on life end up defining farmers from whom seeds have come as thieves. It is the basis for this crazy situation we have today, where a company which poisoned the underground aquifers of a place in Massachusetts, there's a whole, it's the most famous, Woburn, right, W.R. Grace. W.R. Grace has the largest set of patents for products and processes for the use of neem, this tree we have had in India and used. My mother used it, my grandmother used it. We use the leaves to protect our silk saris. We use the leaves for our grain. We make pesticide out of it. We have fungicide. It is our toothbrush. We chew the end, do dantun. It's the skin treatment. It's, go for an Ayurvedic massage. They give you a neem oil massage. You go to tribal areas. They, you know, put neem oil in them, walk into the forest, never have malaria. And suddenly, Grace is the inventor of the pesticide users and the fungicidal users of neem. We put a challenge. And we put a challenge in the US, and we put a challenge in Europe, because they had patents in both places. Interestingly, in the US, we could not have our case admitted, because the US courts only recognize a fight over commercial benefit. And we were talking about our intellectual heritage. The European laws have clauses based on ethics, and we could translate the piracy of our heritage into an ethical and justice issue. But that's just one. I come from a place called Dehradun, famous for basmati. Dehradun's a tiny little valley, and by and large, when you buy Dehraduni basmati, it can't be from Dehradun because it's so tiny it couldn't be supplying the whole world. It still has the most aromatic and best basmati. But they have fake basmati all over, and one of the companies that has fake basmati is a company called Ricetech, which for a while sold its basmatis as Texmati, but in 98 became bolder and claimed a patent on rice derived from our basmatis and called it basmati. Double theft, both in terms of the claim to the aromatic quality, but also if you read that patent claim, it says, I mean, it has about 12 claims in it, including heights of plants from 2 feet to 4 feet, that much variation, it's all theirs, their invention. Grain length, aroma they hardly mention because their rice doesn't really have aroma. Though basmati means the rice, the queen of aroma. The really interesting thing about the rice tech patent to me is, first that they say that this is a claim to an invention, and no, an instant invention of a novel rice line. So, you know, I mean, according to creation myths, the Christian God took 7 days. But Ricetech, instant creation of life. and absolutely novel, when all they took is rice samples which had gone to Erie from India and Pakistan, and from Erie were collected by Fort Collins, and from Fort Collins were taken by Ricetech. The second thing about their claim is they do these surveys with consumers, and the consumers basically can't make out between authentic basmati and Ricetech's basmati, and so, and therefore we will call it basmati. And the only thing they've done that peasants never did is actually go around measuring the grain length. I mean, no peasant who grows a good crop will ever take a vernier calipers and work out the grain length. Well, I sued the government of India for not having taken action through the WTO, through international fora, and through national laws also, to prevent this epidemic of piracy, because this is really becoming an epidemic. We use Karela, it's called the bitter gourd, and jamun for diabetes cure. It's recorded in all Ayurvedic texts. It's used by everyone in India. That's patented. Pepper. You know, in Indian meals, black pepper is a very important ingredient. It's very good for digestion. It is recognized as digestive in Ayurvedic texts. It's been patented for its digestive properties. And the company that has the patent for it is now trying to prevent other companies from trading in pepper in the US. Just like the latest case that Rafi announced about an American going across to Mexico, going to a market, buying beans, selecting the beans, you know, you always have multicolored beans, separating the yellow beans from the other colors, growing it out one season, taking a patent on it, and then suing other trading groups from bringing yellow beans to the US market. Because a patent is, one, it's supposed to be a recognition of a new invention that's new in a non-obvious way. And the right it gives you is an exclusive right to make, produce, sell, distribute the product for which you have a patent. It is, on the one hand, a claim to invention, but on the other hand, an exclusive monopoly on markets. And that is the only reason it was brought into the trade treaty. Because as the companies start to get monopolies through patents, they will do what these smaller companies are doing today. Sue others. Grace has a plant in India. It's got the patents here. It would, like 5 years down the line, prevent every small-scale industry from making its neem pesticides, its neem soaps, its neem toothpaste. There are other elements in the international trading system that also contribute to the stolen harvest. I don't know how many of you followed a news this was around the end of December, about a new agreement between US and India. It was an agreement written during the hijack of the Indian airline planes to Afghanistan. It had been finalized, it was not announced. And it's very interesting, here are these two giant-sized democracies in the world. And how our economies will run is not determined at the level of our parliaments. It is determined by two trade bureaucrats corresponding with each other and saying this is an agreement between our peoples. And this particular agreement is an agreement for India to dismantle all restrictions on imports.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, recorded by Alternative Radio, speaking recently at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and author of Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The fire that's raged out of control in Los Alamos was set by the National Park Service. It was supposed to be a control burn, and now a team of investigators has arrived in the state to try to figure out why that fire got out of control. Los Alamos is still burning. It's claimed 260 homes and burned at least 44,000 acres. In addition, an Indian reservation, a Puebla, burned, including its historic sites. Well, more than three quarters of Los Alamos was reopened to residents yesterday despite this damage. The Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory, though, remains closed. A complex of historic buildings where scientists assembled the first atomic bomb was consumed by the wildfire. The laboratory said in a statement the complex where the scientists worked on the top-secret Manhattan Project to build the bomb was destroyed in the fire except for one building. We're joined right now by Peggy Prince, director of Peace Action New Mexico, and Carol Miller, 30-year public health veteran who ran for Congress on the Green Party ticket two times. Carol Miller, what's your gravest concern right now?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what's happening with the fire, but one thing that I found quite astounding was how unprepared people were for the health impacts of this fire. Just as recently as April 26th of this year, the laboratory co-hosted a seminar in the community called Wildfire 2000 Los Alamos at Risk. And at that seminar, they had a number of agencies coming, but there was no involvement from either the State Department of Health or any other health agencies. And it was pretty obvious that at some point there was going to be a fire up there. There had been two very strong fires in the last few years, one giant one in 1977 and then the Dome Fire in 1996. And one thing that I found very disconcerting was that there were not enough materials available to protect the health of the firefighters. For example, firefighters should have been wearing badges just so we could have learned if there had been any releases of radiation. They needed special breathing apparatus. The lab has quite a large budget and did not appear to make any preparation to protect health of people in a fire that they were waiting to happen.
What do you understand has happened in terms of nuclear waste and nuclear weapons?
Well, you know, we have been told that there were no releases, although the other day one of the people from the Forest Service did talk about what they called legacy releases, and that is where radiation has been taken up from some of the old dump sites or some of the early areas where it's been taken up and actually is in the trees and the grasses, and they did talk about that. But what I think a lot of people don't realize, particularly people around the country, is that radiation was not even my immediate concern once it appeared that a lot of those materials had been stored away. Los Alamos is, we call it a toxic soup up there. There are a lot of other toxic materials that we were worried about. And the red flag for me as someone working in public health is they kept saying, there's nothing to worry about. Our special nuclear materials are safe. And when I would call the health department or the congressional delegation and ask, what about other materials? Were there any PCBs on those fire poles, the power lines? You know, were any of those released by the fire? What happens when a lot of other materials burn? And the total deniability of the lab, that was their position, to just repeating over and over that there was no problem. If they had been forthcoming and said, you know, we did lose some power lines. Some of them, the transformers had not been updated. We did lose a lot of automobiles, and we know they had lead-acid batteries, and there might be 15 pounds of lead in the air. If they had actually stated to the public what was happening up there instead of the total deniability, I think it would have been really important. What was sad for me is that nobody seemed to want to pay any attention. Nobody wanted to badge the workers. The firefighters probably should have received urine tests when they came out so that their urine could have been bioassayed for toxic exposures. None of that preventive work was done. There's still a question about the toxicity just of forest fire smoke and leaving, for example, pregnant women who were in the smoke plume for a number of days. There are a lot of public health questions that some of us have concerns about that were not answered because all we heard was no problem.
We're talking to Carol Miller, who ran for Congress on the Green Party ticket twice. Also, Peggy Prince joins us, director of Peace Action New Mexico. She just met yesterday with the New Mexico State Environment Department. What are your major concerns right now, Peggy Prince?
Yes, my major concerns have to do with what is the lab going to do now? It's our understanding that Los Alamos is planning on reopening the functions of the laboratory within the next few days. And that brings a tremendous concern to us from the point of view that the administration and the Department of Energy are planning on ramping up the production of nuclear weapons plutonium components at Los Alamos National Lab, basically the function that Rocky Flats was serving for so many years. And, of course, we know that Rocky Flats is just tremendously and irrevocably polluted and has been shut down. So we're concerned about that, but we're very pleased as well that the New Mexico Environment Department has taken the request from the public and from Peace Action New Mexico to be testing the soil for contaminants, both toxic and radiological. And I think they've really stepped up to the plate. The problem at this point is how much control will Los Alamos National Lab and the Department of Energy have over the testing, and what sorts of quote-unquote national security issues will be brought into place to prevent testing at certain sites.
Well, Peggy Prince of Peace Action, this raises a very important point. You've got the convergence of a wildfire that is out of control, but you also have it hitting a national security site, a national weapons lab, and information is top secret at labs like these. So how can you trust the kind of information you're getting right now about this fire, what has burned, what kind of damage there is to the environment, what kind of potential threats people in the area face going back, as they're saying, being repatriated now?
Well, I don't think that up until this point we can trust the information that's coming out. There has been no independent assessment being done. Historically, the Department of Energy and Los Alamos National Lab have had a tremendous level of arrogance and disregard for the health and safety not only of the workers at the lab, but also of the surrounding communities, which are largely poor agricultural, Hispano, and Native American. And that is why we approached the New Mexico Environment Department, because we felt that not only did the state have to be involved almost from the very beginning, but also that we need to be pushing for independent agencies to come in, companies that can do monitoring and testing of soil samples, especially now. But at Peace Action, we're also calling on our affiliates that are in Texas and Colorado, Arkansas, and all down the line where that plume of toxic smoke is going, that they need to be talking to their own environmental protection agencies and have testing done on those plumes that are no longer here, but they're certainly downwind.
It's interesting. I've been trying to get as much information as I can from the corporate media about what's happening in Los Alamos. I've also been trying to get any kind of information, but curious what kind of national picture is being painted about what's happening in Los Alamos. And I haven't seen any peace activists, though I know the Los Alamos Study Group, your group Peace Action, environmentalists in the area have been very concerned. What kind of coverage are you getting raising issues, for example, about not just monitoring now, but cleaning up nuclear waste, et cetera?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, Amy. It's kind of like the media has been orchestrated just as they were orchestrated during the toxic releases during the Gulf War and in the war in Kosovo. The media pretty much marches in lockstep for the most part, except, of course, for you. And in reporting, they take the lead from the government agency, in this case, the Department of Energy. And the really unfortunate thing is that it may be months, perhaps years, before people can find out the straight information. And in the meantime, the elders are being harmed. children, infirmed people. There are a lot of organic growers in northern New Mexico who may be experiencing toxic ash coming down on their crops. This is a tremendous concern to all of us. You know, folks in northern New Mexico are independent and certainly willing to take responsibility for their own health. You know, they're very resourceful, and all they need is the straight information.
And Amy, we can never get the information that was not gathered during the fire. That's gone forever. I have to tell you that from Wednesday at 1:30 when they announced they were evacuating Los Alamos, I spent probably 15 hours straight on the phone trying to get the Department of Health, our congressional delegation, others to start doing the testing. We should have done random sampling of testing in the communities that lived under this toxic plume for days. I mean, I live 35 air miles from Los Alamos, and large chunks of bark and other ash landed all over my organic garden and the gardens of my neighbors. And one thing we keep hearing from the Department of Energy, that the people of Los Alamos are going to be made whole. And that's very important. And I know the organic gardeners are meeting the agricultural people to find out if they can get disaster assistance, if in fact their crops are not going to be organic this year. We know that a lot of materials will be washing into the rivers in the rainy season. They probably will not be able to build dams fast enough or reseed to hold all the materials on that very steep hillside. What does that mean for growers downstream? We need to make sure that everybody who has been harmed by this has some access to that disaster assistance and not just the people up on the hill. I mean, it's important that they get it, but also the people who are impacted downstream. But because we didn't test, we're going to be in a position, just like people who lived around Three Mile Island. That's a good example, I think, for us to use. They weren't doing the testing, and when it came time to do a court case, the communities didn't have the information. We have the technology to test sputum, where people actually spit, and you can see what materials are present there. You can do urine testing, blood testing. None of that was done.
You're talking about this totally in the past tense, Carol Miller. Is there any way to do this all now?
Well, I've been talking to physicians all over the country that work on these kinds of situations, and some of it can be done. You know, a lot of the firefighters that came in from out of state, it's going to be difficult to get the testing done with them. Some of it is the immediate impacts will never be known. And there are a couple things that we're suggesting. There's a project that I think you've covered that looks at collecting deciduous teeth, the baby teeth, and we're going to advocate that we collect baby teeth that are falling out right now so that we have a baseline that in 5 years and 7 years we can compare with the baby teeth for the children who were born after this fire or who may have been in utero during the fire. And there is some of that we can do, but who's going to do it is the question. The Department of Health, I spoke to them on Friday and mentioned that they already own a mobile sputum testing clinic that they could have moved into the area because it's available at the Miners Hospital, which is a state facility in Raton, New Mexico, and that was not done. And what I found is people would tell me, oh, that's a really good idea. We're going to bring it up at a meeting at the command center, and it seems that once things got to the command center, fighting the fire issue became preeminent and some of the public health concerns became secondary.
Peggy Prince of Peace Action, what about the Puebla that burned?
Yes, this is perhaps one of the largest tragedies because you know that this is a very ancient land since you've been here. Unfortunately, fire and smoke have destroyed several sacred sites on the Santa Clara, Pueblo, and also possibly San Ildefonso. The Puye Cliff dwellings have been affected, and several other sacred sites and culturally significant sites. This has been a huge tragedy for the Pueblo peoples in northern New Mexico because they live off the land, they hunt and fish off the land, and grow their own crops. and have a very deep spiritual connection. The Los Alamos National Laboratory has deeply affected their lives now.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. If you want to give out numbers where people can call to get more information, what would they be of Peggy Prince of Peace Action?
Yes, our telephone number at Peace Action New Mexico is 505-989-4812, and the website for Peace Action is www.peace-action.org.
Peace-action.org. And Carol Miller.
I can be reached at 505-689-2361. And anyone who wants to help with health information they know about or questions is welcome to call.
Peggy Prince of Peace Action and Carol Miller, former Green Party candidate for Congress in New Mexico. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill, with help from Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!